pushing folks around. Genies in the backseat, polish and crown, going left, going back. Well, Bush 2 is in the White House and passing tax reform. Give a trillion to his rich friends by stealing from the poor. Don't blink your eyes, it's still the story. Corporations and the Pentagon is cooking up the wars. Armies and the State House and fuck you, Jim Brooks, and the O'Connor. Well, Poppy Bush and Baby Bush and the party of God, that's well, cheaper guns and hope for oil and cheaper drugs. I gave us 911, was an inside job. George Bush and the White House spreading fear across the land, hearing about a Bill of Rights as fast as they can. World terror, such a scam. Well, Collins at the UN just showing guy grins. Can't you see those weapons just scattered across the land? He's making deals, he's shaking hands. Wolfies at the World Bank, making new demands, will take your oil, you keep saying. We got Evergreen in the Middle East, Guantanamo down south. Congress got that Patriot Act, just shoved them down its mouth. They took our Constitution and threw it out. They'll call over the White House and they say he's pushing the brain. All these corporate parties and their phony machines, we cast our votes, they wipe the green. Stole the White House, now they're shooting for the world. Torture and police states and preemptive war, the fourth Reich's here in America. King George and the White House is pushing folks around. Chains in the backseat, polish in the crown. We're going down, we're going down.
Good evening, this is Truth Quest with Melody and co-host Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And tonight, and that was Bluegrass Conspiracy and the Washington House or White House Blues with Dr. Eric Carlstrom playing the banjo and singing. And tonight we have a guest with us, Lauren Murray, and she is I will never get this down right. Okay, she's a nuclear weapons lab whistleblower. Murray has spoken in 46 countries and feels it's her obligation to share the devastating results of her research, which she began after working at two nuclear weapons laboratories in California from the 70s to 91. And, Lauren, are you there? Did we lose her? Are you there, Lauren?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there we go. I always have these little adjustments on here. So, do you want to go ahead and introduce your, you know, anything more to that background that I need to, that I missed?
Oh, well, I'm a geoscientist, and basically they study the Earth and Earth processes. And it's an interdisciplinary field, and it's a very, very good background, probably the best scientific background you can have to understand radiation issues. So I feel very lucky to be doing this and serving humanity as a citizen scientist.
Well, I'm sure glad that you've found the time to join our program, and tonight, Rich, the subject is going to be on DU, and anything else that, you know, happens to...
That's depleted uranium, correct?
Yeah. Yes. And anything else that happens to come along that, because I know Lauren has more of a background than just the depleted uranium, but I think it's a good subject to start on. So I'll let Dr. Carlstrom go ahead and begin here.
Okay, well, I'll just introduce myself real briefly since I teach geography, physical geography, at California State University, Stanislaus, and my field is geomorphology, soils, and climatology. So there will be some overlap with my interests and those of our guest, Loren, who is now speaking to us from Berkeley, California. And I've had a chance to read some of your articles, Loren, and wow, we all have a lot to be grateful for the work you're doing. It seems a little bit like, since you have taken on this role of international emissary, kind of whistleblower on the effects of nuclear radiation, as in depleted uranium, etc., that you are kind of carrying on the work of another famous environmentalist, Helen Caldicott. I was just wondering if you if you're familiar with her and whether you two communicate at all. She was very inspiring writer and speaker internationally back in the 80s and 90s.
Well, she's still having an impact, and it's so terribly important for people like her to inform the general public, and it's kind of unusual for scientists to really communicate with the public. Now, very early on, I was interested in making science transparent for citizens because basically citizens, through taxation, have supported scientific research for decades, and they really should benefit from it. But a lot of it gets hijacked and by private entities, and then it ends up being turned against citizens and really harming them. And when I really understood the implications and the impact that depleted uranium poison gas weapons are having, not just locally or regionally, but globally, there was no choice but to dedicate my life to warning humanity about this global poisoning of all living things.
Could you explain perhaps the positions, the jobs that you had at Lawrence Livermore Lab, et cetera, where you learned and were exposed to these kinds of this kind of information?
Well, I went to UC Davis and graduated in 1968. I was the first woman to graduate in that department. And I didn't really know what to do, so I worked for a year and went to Europe for 10 years and went on expeditions and worked for Louis Leakey in Africa and did many really exciting things and a lot of adventure. And then I came back to the U.S. and I did my master's degree in Near Eastern Studies, in other words, the ancient history of the Middle East and Central Asia at UC Berkeley. And then I still didn't know how to get a job, so I found a job at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, which is where the Manhattan Project started, and it was at that time a nuclear weapons laboratory. And I was totally oblivious. I had no idea what nuclear weapons were. I was just interested in having fun and going on field trips. And later on, I ended up at the Lawrence Livermore Lab. I was a single parent, and it was a place where I had a lot of freedom on my job to be able to take care of my daughter. And I still didn't know what nuclear weapons were. I was working on the Yucca Mountain Project and on the Superfund Project, and I actually became a whistleblower on both projects and just walked out of the lab one day in 1991, and I just said, scientists are prostitutes for the military and corporations, and I just didn't want to do that anymore. And little did I know that when you walk over that line, you get the Karen Silkwood experience. And there are many scientists who've been murdered by the University of California and the nuclear weapons labs, as well as beaten up and harassed almost to death. And, of course, once you blow the whistle on the nuclear weapons program in the U.S., your career is ruined for the rest of your life. But I'm very grateful that they ruined my career, because because I'm doing the greatest thing I could ever do in my life as a scientist and as a human being, and that is to warn humanity about the terrible effects of nuclear technology. And they've caused global illnesses that are escalating and increasing. They've damaged the environment. They have altered, the effects have altered the DNA of the whole genome of the entire planet, which took 4.5 billion years to develop, and we've completely changed it in 50 years. And it's really, really very, very serious.
Well, before we get into the details of that, Loren, and before we find out perhaps what kind of a price you paid for being a whistleblower, could you explain just a little bit to our listeners about the Yucca Mountain Project? Because I think that does relate a lot to what we're talking about here.
Yes, the amount of nuclear waste produced in the United States since the Manhattan Project in World War II, which was a secret project to develop atomic weapons, which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That program, as well as the nuclear power program and all kinds of military activities and civilian activities, have produced a huge volume of horrifically dangerous radioactive waste. And there is nowhere to put it. There's absolutely nowhere to put it because there's no safe way to store it. And I was working on something called the Yucca Mountain Project at Livermore in the late 1980s. And the U.S. government has selected the Nevada test site after being kicked out of every state in the U.S. for 50 years where they tried to build a repository. They finally went to Nevada where they conducted over 1,000 nuclear bomb tests, and so that part of Nevada is so radioactive, it's a national sacrifice zone, and they said, gee, well, we own that property and control it, so we'll just build the repository there. And the problem is that it's in an active volcanic region. It's in an active tectonic region, the second most active in the United States. In other words, there's 30 to 40 earthquakes every month where that repository is planned to be constructed. And there are actually hot springs under the repository. It's supposed to be completely dry, and it should be geologically stable. And they just picked the worst place in the world. It's going to be a moving Chernobyl if they ever construct it, but it's now very clear that they can't. And it was just, that's when I became a whistleblower. There was so much science fraud and contractor fraud, and it was despicable. And that is the most important public works project that has ever been undertaken in the U.S., and it was nothing but science fraud.
I believe in one of your articles you mentioned that something like $3 billion were spent to try to find a site that would be safe for this high-level radioactive waste. Is that correct?
That's right, and I'll tell you what happened at Yucca Mountain. Well, it started in New Mexico at the WIP project, Waste Isolation Pilot Project, which was conducted first, or sort of contemporaneously, and I was at Livermore when the canisters came back from the WIP project in New Mexico, and the bacteria had eaten the metal canisters that the waste was stored in less than 5 years. Now, they are mandated by court order and by the requirements and recommendations of the National Academy of Sciences to make that waste safe for something like 100,000 years. And they couldn't even keep the waste in the canisters for 5 years. And the same thing happened at Yucca Mountain. Because bacteria eat metals like Wheaties for breakfast.
Okay. Hmm. So, and a matter of fact, I was a professor in Flagstaff, Arizona, Northern Arizona University during the 80s, and I remember a number of my colleagues who were actually working on this project, trying to find the ideal place in America where it would be safe to put these high-level nuclear wastes. And some people were working in Utah, some people were working in Washington, some people working in Nevada. And as I recall, it kind of turned into a NIMBY situation, not in my backyard. And Nevada got it simply because they don't have very many people and they don't have very many votes in Congress.
It was called the Screw Nevada Bill, and the Nevada legislators just didn't have enough political juice in Congress to get it voted down.
Is the New Mexico site still being used, the WHIP?
Yes, marginally. What happened is the New Mexico legislature agreed to a pilot study, but they required that the federal government construct an entire new freeway system in New Mexico. And as soon as the the freeway system and the highway system was completed, they immediately passed a bill and said it's illegal to transport any nuclear waste on New Mexico roads, and so it sort of killed the WHIP project. They tried flying it in, but they got caught, and that just turned into such a political hot potato. They want planes flying nuclear waste into Nevada, New Mexico.
And I noticed Santa Fe had built a bypass, and they were already building homes where the bypass was for this
highway.
Yeah,
that's right. And so it ended up finally in Nevada, and it's just there are trucks and trailers going all day and all night onto the Nevada test site. Nobody knows what they're doing, but they are just dumping nuclear waste down holes. And into craters and into old bomb craters. And they had a secret EPA dairy at the Nevada test site all during atmospheric testing. And the nuclear weapons program at Livermore, which needed that data, they were building the bombs that were being tested at the Nevada test site. And the officials at the Nevada test site refused to give them the data on their own bomb tests. And this woman, Sally Devlin, a little old lady in tennis shoes, is a great friend, and she got a lot of documents declassified for me, and she's the one who got the documents on the secret EPA dairy in Nevada. And what it means is that the cows and the manure and the calves and the bulls and the beef herds, they were all completely radioactive, and they had to be buried as high-level nuclear waste. And the report said, and the workers at the dairy were just as radioactive as the cows.
Wow. Now, just to kind of conclude this thing about the Yucca Mountain repository, would it be correct to say that I had heard that the year was slated to be 2012, is there a year estimated completion for this thing, or is it just kind of now off the table?
It's it's still being funded at some level, but a court reviewing the situation with the Yucca Mountain Project 2 years ago basically told the Department of Energy that they had only guaranteed, the Department of Energy only guaranteed the nuclear waste would be safe 10,000 years. And the court said, you violated the recommendation of the National Academy of Sciences, which you must follow. And that was, it has to be safe over 100,000 years. And so the judge said, basically, all your science is garbage. Throw it in the garbage can and start all over again.
Oh, boy. And, of course, this is the conclusion that you had come to before you blew the whistle, I guess.
Oh, yeah. And the same liars that I saw at Livermore, I've been going to the DOE meetings in Nevada, and they're the ones doing the phony presentations and reporting on, you know, it's all science fraud. And finally, the independent committee, which was appointed by Congress a sort of an oversight board that would make recommendations to the President of the United States and Congress. I was in the room when they just said this project is a science fraud, and it happened when one of the scientists I knew was doing a presentation, and the repository has to be absolutely dry because you cannot allow high-level nuclear waste to get water in it. It will explode and turn into a Chernobyl. And one of the women scientists on the board said to the scientist, "What's all that water in this instrument room in the repository underground?" And he said, "Well, we put a tarp over the instruments so they wouldn't get wet." And she said, "Well, how much water is dripping in that room?" And he said, "Oh, it was like 50 gallons an hour or something." And the whole nuclear waste recommendation board just about keeled over, and they wrote a horrible letter to the President and Congress. And so that independent board and the court in the Washington, D.C. district pretty much killed the Yucca Mountain project.
So could you tell us, Lorraine, do you have an idea who controls the nuclear industry? Is it particular?
Oh, the nuclear industry is controlled by the City of London. They pretty much own the whole nuclear industry. That's the London bankers who have been money lenders since the Roman Empire and even before that. And it would be the Rothschilds or the face of it. The Rothschilds control uranium prices and supplies globally. The Queen of England owns all the mineral rights to all of Canada and all of Australia, which are the two biggest uranium producers. So that's her own private uranium that's being mined now, as well as vast deposits that she owns in Africa. But I'll tell you, Eric, I was looking at a mining industry website about a month ago, and I discovered that Kazakhstan will outproduce Canada, which is the biggest producer, by 2012. And also Afghanistan is very, very rich in uranium deposits. So we see more vested interest and incentives for 9/11, because it was the excuse used to militarily establish a presence in Central Asia. So it's tied to energy, not just oil and gas, but uranium deposits as well.
That's fascinating. Now, can I ask you how you found out, or what leads you to say that the City of London and the Rothschild family and the Queen of England essentially own the uranium industry? I mean, I've read this, but I just wonder how you verify something like that.
Well, I went to the 9/11 conference in Vancouver just a couple months ago, and it was at the end of June, the last week in June, and I was talking to Canadians who had traveled all the way across Canada just to talk to me about uranium. They want a uranium citizens Geiger counter movement in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania now, because they heard about my Geiger counter movement in Hawaii. And they said, well, one of them said to me casually, well, you know, anybody can just come and start mining or drilling for oil on your land in Canada. And I said, Well, don't you own the mineral rights when you buy a piece of property? And they said, oh, no, the Queen of England owns all the mineral rights in Canada and Australia. And I was just astounded. But there is a book published by Executive International Review, EIR, I think it's a Lyndon LaRouche investigative arm. And they did a very interesting book on Tiny Roland and neo-colonialism in Africa. And it turns out that, boy, did this book dish out the dirt. It turns out that Tiny Roland was born in Germany, and he was in the Nazi Youth Corps. And he was a convicted criminal in Germany before he moved to England. He changed his name to Tiny Roland and became the Queen's her right-hand man. I call him her buccaneer. And he set up Rio Tinto mines for her personal uranium holdings. Hardly anybody knows that. And he was the biggest Western businessman in Africa, and he economically colonized Africa after the African countries were turned back over to black leadership. And I also worked with Dr. Jay Gould on the Radiation and Public Health Project, and he was hired by Westinghouse to investigate why uranium prices were going up all over the world during the oil embargo in the 70s when there was a glut of uranium on the world market, and he discovered that the Rothschilds controlled uranium prices and supplies globally, and that the Queen of England owned the uranium, and he actually published it in his book, Deadly Deceit.
Dr. Jay Gould, Deadly Deceit. Is that
the
book?
Right.
Okay, thank you. That's extremely useful information.
Yes.
Now, could you explain a little bit about the price that you paid individually as a whistleblower? It gives an idea of the fact that these people play hardball.
Well, I had no idea what retaliation was. You don't even really know what's going on at a nuclear weapons lab because everything is compartmentalized and on a need-to-know basis. And I can assure you, Eric, that we wouldn't have a nuclear weapons program if American citizens had been informed about the effects on the Japanese people. And so I decided that I finally couldn't work at Livermore anymore in 1991, and I had a small daughter, and one day I just put everything in my office that belonged to me into my car, and I drove out the gate, and I dropped off my badge and beeper, and I said, well, I just got out of jail, and I drove home laughing, and I just felt pretty happy, and the retaliation started the very next day, and I was gang stalked, and they used electromagnetic frequency weapons, which they are still targeting me with. And I discovered not very long ago that pieces of legislation that have been passed since 1993 actually are a contract, establish a contract for universities, colleges, and private institutions to test the non-lethal weapons or electromagnetic weapons that are developed in the nuke labs, and they're combined with gang stalking, and the universities, colleges, and private institutions in the U.S. are paid to test these weapons and to practice on other students and on citizens, and the three worst places for gang stalking and EMF attacks are California, because of the University of California, and Texas, because of the University of Texas and other universities there, and Boston, which is where MIT is.
Lorraine, could you define what you mean by gang stalking and EMS attacks?
EMF, electromagnetic frequency.
Oh, EMF, okay, got
yes,
it.
Yes, these are called cop toys. And they were turned over by the military to law enforcement in the United States in 1993, and I read about it in the Wall Street Journal because there were many businessmen at that meeting. There were 500 scientists, and there was law enforcement from all over the U.S., and it was a classified meeting held at Johns Hopkins University in the Applied Physics Laboratory. And for a week, the scientists demonstrated microwave weapons and all kinds of stuff to law enforcement, and the businessmen were there because they were going to make billions of dollars manufacturing these technologies for law enforcement in the U.S. And there have been reports in the mainstream media about the military targeting civilians and military people in Afghanistan and Iraq with EMF weapons, with microwave weapons. And these are now established in all police departments and in the police antennas in the United States. And they are combined with gangs of people who are recruited in every town, every city, to target individuals who are politically undesirable or have been targeted to politically control. And the first place they used them was at the nuclear weapons lab on whistleblowers like me. Mm-hmm. Then they were turned over to the EPA to use on environmentalists. And at the Judy Berry Earth First trial, which I attended for 2 months in Oakland Federal Court, some of the Earth Firsters reported being targeted with electromagnetic weapons and also gang stalking. And then they were also turned over to the FBI to be used by law enforcement. And the police antennas are used to target individuals or a crowd, and they keep you awake all night so that you have horrible sleep deprivation, or they can make you go to sleep and you just can't wake up. The Wall Street Journal article said that police can just bake people in their cars like a baked potato with microwave. It said they can give them heart attacks from a mile away. And it's very interesting that Homeland Security has the serial number on every heart a heart pacemaker?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Manufactured in the United States.
Okay, so now you're talking about what we call exotic weapons, is that right?
Yeah, call them NLW, non-lethal weapons, but they're exotic weapons and they're secret weapons. And I also discovered that the Woodpecker signal, which was over the horizon radar, turned on July 4th, 1976 in Russia, became a secret project between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in 1978 at a UN treaty signing conference to prohibit development of environmental weapons or damaging the environment with weapons. And that was very interesting. 68 countries agreed to not to do it. The U.S. and the Soviet Union made a secret agreement to develop them at that very same conference. And I could never figure out why they were doing that or who in the United States, what institution was actually sending scientists to the Soviet Union, and they sent a 40-ton magnet and all kinds of equipment. Well, this is very interesting. I was also investigating HARP, the High Atmospheric Auroral Research Project around the Arctic Circle, which is three huge antennas to manipulate the Earth's magnetic field and to do weather modification and tectonic warfare. What it turned out when I did the investigation, it took me 5 years to tease it all out, but the antenna for HARP was developed through the Woodpecker signal. And the Woodpecker signal was transmitted from the seven largest antennas in the world on the east and the west sides of the Soviet Union. And these beams were transmitted, their microwaves, over the horizon, and they were focused on different populations in the U.S. And there were actual reports in the mainstream media I remember there was a community in Oregon that people got sick and dizzy and they were throwing up and things like that. Well, that was the woodpecker signal, and that's where the hardware for the antenna for HARP was developed. And I finally found a physicist who told me he had worked on the development of the HARP antenna at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab.
Wow. Lorraine, I really want to come back to these exotic weapons and microwaves and directed energy weapons, et cetera. But before we do that, could we talk a little bit about DU, depleted uranium? I know this is an area you've really done a lot of work with. And you could you tell us how the stuff, what the stuff is, how it's been used, and what the effects of DU exposure are and how widespread those are?
Sure. I just want to just finish just a couple sentences on the HARP project. MK Ultra was part of HARP also, and that's where the software was developed through the Monkey Colony at UC Davis and Edward Teller and Nelson Rockefeller. And the safe house for MK Ultra was in Livermore, next to a big antenna field. So Livermore is where they put the antenna and the mind control together for HARP. And the laser project at Livermore, it's called Shiva, is part of HARP. So this is global mind control, weather control. Hurricane Katrina and the Sumatra earthquake were triggered by HARP.
Yikes.
So.
Okay. Now you said so much there. I'm afraid we have to follow up a little bit on that.
Oh, well, we can do it after.
Okay. I certainly want to know what the connection is.
Well, we can even do a program on it.
Okay.
But what I'm really concerned about is this intensified militarization in Colorado, and it's a very, very serious issue for all Coloradans, as well as people in states around you. So let's talk about the depleted uranium, and then we can go back to HARP.
And then we can go to the militarization of Colorado.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah, let's start with the DU. That's very important.
Okay. So depleted uranium is the radioactive trash from the Manhattan Project to begin with. And that was where they were trying to make atomic bombs because they thought Germany was in World War II. And when uranium is mined in the ground, it occurs in three ratios for the three isotopes that occur in nature. And so uranium-238 is 99.3% of what they mine. And that's not good for anything, but it is very radioactive. And then 0.72% of the uranium in the ground is uranium-235, which will fission. In other words, it can instantaneously release the huge amounts of energy from the nucleus that form in supernovas. Uranium is created in supernovas under extreme energetic circumstances, and then there's just a tiny trace, less than a tenth of a percent of uranium-234. And so they mine the uranium, they extract the metal, the uranium metal, and then they turn it into uranium hexafluoride gas, and they pass it through membranes to try to get as much of the uranium-235 out as they can.
Lorraine, is that hexafluoride gas, is that somewhere I thought I'd heard that was kind of that byproduct from that process was part of the fluoride they put in water. Am I correct? Is that
yes, I'm going to talk about that.
Okay.
Yes. And so when they get half a percent of U-235 separated from the rest of the uranium, they stop the process and they turn the uranium hexafluoride gas back into metal. Or they can take the waste, which is called depleted uranium, it's 99.5% of what they mine, And that's called depleted uranium because it's depleted in uranium-235. And then they take the U-235 and they make bombs, or they make fourth-generation nuclear weapons out of it, or they make fuel rods for nuclear power plants. And they had a choice. They can either store the uranium hexafluoride gas, the depleted uranium, in big drums, but it's extremely corrosive, and it's a horrible neurotoxin. It's a terrible poison, and it's very difficult to think of ways to dispose of it. And since they produced huge amounts of depleted uranium, thousands of them, over a million tons of it, they had quite a big problem on their hands. So Edward Teller said, well, let's just dump all that really toxic, nasty, corrosive fluoride, which is a horrible neurotoxin, into the drinking water of America and into the reservoirs and into the public water supplies, and we'll just dilute it, and nobody will know.
Was Teller a eugenicist?
Teller was a Rockefeller contractor. Mm-hmm. Teller was already had a Rockefeller fellowship when he had left university in Hungary, and he went to Copenhagen to spend a year in Niels Bohr's lab before he was recruited and brought to the U.S. So he was already a Rockefeller contractor before he left Europe. And if you trace his history as well as the history of the major decision makers who have made all these horrible decisions on the whole nuclear project, they're almost all Rockefeller contractors or City of London contractors. Basically, the Rockefellers worked for the Rothschilds or the City of London. And all these problems, all of these wars, this horrible international war crimes racketeering syndicate, it's the Wall Street bankers and the London bankers. It's the Zionist Anglo-American economic empire. So, Teller was happy to poison America, and it's very strange. It was deliberate. It was not an accident or an oversight, because the Nazis put fluoride into the drinking water in the slave camps during World War II to subdue and dumb down the slaves. And what is happening right now is cities that have never had fluoridated water, and this is not just in the U.S., it's in England too, are being forced to fluoridate their water now, and it's just to dumb down the population.
Wow. Now, Edward Teller was a Nazi, isn't that correct? A Nazi rocket scientist, basically.
No. Edward Teller was a Hungarian nuclear scientist, but he was really never a successful scientist. He was really a con man and a politician, politico. And he couldn't even make the hydrogen bomb work. It was Ulam, who was a mathematician, who did the mathematics that made it possible to construct the hydrogen bomb. And so Teller is known as the father of the hydrogen bomb generally, but he always said, I am referred to as the father of the hydrogen bomb. He was very careful not to say, I did it, because everyone knew Ulam had done it. So, but Ulam's wife didn't want anyone to know that her husband had done it, because she hated nuclear bombs.
Okay, so back to DU. Now, what happened with DU? It was stored for a long time, and then the Pentagon...
Well, what happened is, under the Manhattan Project, the atomic bombs were developed, but they didn't really know if they would work or not until they tested them. And they didn't test them until the Trinity test at Los Alamos in 1945. And there is something called the Groves Memo, which is the blueprint for depleted uranium weapons. And basically they said, well, we don't know if the bombs will work, but uranium burns at temperatures that are hotter than the sun. It forms a radioactive poison gas that can contaminates the air, the water, the blood, the food, the soil of a region. And if we can't get atomic bombs to work, we can use dirty bombs, dirty missiles, and dirty bullets. But the only problem was, in the memo, they said there's no way to make any protective clothing against it. It goes through all air filters and all gas masks, through all protective clothing, and it still does today. And there's no way to avoid contaminating your own troops. So it was deemed to be too horrific a weapon to use in World War II, so they kind of put it on the shelf. And they also developed Agent Orange, or the prototype for Agent Orange, a hormone that would defoliate trees and starve a population to death. So the three most horrific and environmentally damaging weapon systems in the history of militarism were developed under the Manhattan Project in World War II. And the first depleted uranium weapon system that we found in patent office records was 1968, when a Gatling gun type weapon system was developed for the Navy to use on their ships to shoot down incoming missiles or planes. And by 1973, which, you know, coincided with the oil embargo, depleted uranium had been developed into weapon systems, and it was turned over by the U.S. government to Israel to be used under U.S. supervision in the Yom Kippur War, in the Golan Heights of Israel, and it wiped out the Arab and Egyptian tanks. So they immediately went into full-blown development of depleted uranium weapon systems, and these correlated with oil. And the first one was developed by the Howard Hughes Corporation, the Phalanx system for the Navy. And that was tested in 1974, and within 4 months it was sold to all branches of the U.S. military in 12 countries. No countries have used it except Britain and the U.S. in Gulf War I beginning in 1991, in Yugoslavia, the NATO attack in 1998 on Yugoslavia, in Afghanistan in 2001, and then we gave Israel something like 5,000 depleted uranium bunker busters to use on Lebanon in their attack in July of 2006. And what we've discovered is that those bomb craters in Lebanon were tested at the Harwell Radiation Laboratory in England by Dr. Chris Busby, and they were found to have deuterium, very high levels of uranium-235 that should not have been there, and evidence of neutron activation from the fast neutrons in some kind of a fourth-generation nuclear device that was hidden in the depleted uranium bunker busters. So basically, Israel nuked itself, and they have an epidemic. They had an epidemic of diabetes by December, just 6 months later. And just nuclear technologies, you can't use them without nuking yourself. They just don't work. And so 1991 is when depleted uranium was introduced to the battlefield for the first time. And since 1991, under George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and now George Bush Jr., at least the equivalent of 800,000 Nagasaki bombs have been released through the use of depleted uranium weapons into the atmosphere, and only 40,000 Hiroshima bombs equivalent radiation was released during all of atmospheric testing. So they have completely turned the whole global atmosphere into the Auschwitz radioactive poison gas chamber, and there are about 2 atoms of uranium in every cubic meter of air now globally.
As I understand it, the half-life of depleted uranium is on the order of 4.5 billion years. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And of course, that's about the age of the Earth.
That's the age of the Earth, and it takes 10 half-lives for radiation to diminish to an insignificant amount. Our universe is only about 16 billion years old, and it's going to take 45 billion years for the Earth to get unradioactive.
One must ask, well, of course, you have documented the tremendous effects, the many different kinds of effects from exposure to DU in our soldiers, in the population of Iraq, Yugoslavia, etc. Could you just briefly explain what happens to people and other creatures who are exposed?
Yes, it's affecting all living things, plants, bacteria, the fish in the ocean, mammals, humans, everyone, the birds. And basically, when these weapons burn, a bunker buster is dropped and the uranium shatters into lots of pieces and it burns. It looks like fireworks. And you can see in live media footage of, for instance, the war in Baghdad, that they were using depleted uranium bombs because they looked like fireworks. All these sparklers of burning pieces of uranium go flying out all over the place. And that radioactive poison gas gets up into air masses and air movements and into the troposphere up to about 10,000 feet, which is the most energetic part of the atmosphere, and it's where the storm fronts and hurricanes and rainstorms rain out almost all of the depleted uranium within 2 months. And these huge hurricanes that hit the east coast of the United States originate in North Africa in the Sahara Desert. And they're loaded with uranium from our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yugoslavia and now Lebanon. And it's carried across the Atlantic Ocean and is rained out along the Gulf Coast states. We have the highest diabetes increases in the United States since 1991 in Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. This is the depleted uranium effects from the wars over there in distant countries. And Dr. Busby was able to get air monitoring data. I mean, I predicted all of this because my background is in atmospheric dust. And sure enough, Dr. Busby was able to use the Freedom of Information Act request to get the air monitoring data from the Atomic Weapons Facility in England at Aldermaston. And oh my God. The depleted uranium they were measuring in, during the 2001 Iraq, Afghanistan attack and 2003, the attack on Iraq, was so high, the DU concentration was so high in England that it was required to be reported to the British government. And Dr. Busby actually calculated that any man living within 100 miles of that air monitoring facility would inhale 23 million particles of depleted uranium in 2 weeks. It is so tiny. It's nanoparticles. They are little round, hollow balls like Christmas tree balls of uranium high-temperature oxide. And they go 70% of what goes into your lungs goes right through the blood-lung barrier into the blood, and these tiny particles are carried in the cholesterol or the lipids right into the cells. They uranium is actually, the target organ is the brain. So it does devastating damage to the brain, to the neuromuscular system, to the digestive system, to the heart. Basically, it trashes the body, and that's what Gulf War Syndrome is, and in reality, the whole global population has Gulf War Syndrome now.
Well, now, I can certainly see how depleted uranium radioactive material would cause genetic mutations, birth defects. What's the connection with diabetes?
Well, what what I sort of heard from people that I was interviewing who went to Baghdad after the 2003 war, one was an American wife who was married to an Iraqi-American young man. He was in his 30s, and he wanted to go and see his family after the 2003 Iraq. So she went with him, and she only stayed about a week and came back to Chicago. He stayed 3 weeks and came back, and she called me because she said, my husband was only there 3 weeks, and he's been back 2 months, and he has diabetes. Could this be caused by the DU? And I had no idea there was a link between radiation or depleted uranium and diabetes. So I started going around the world collecting vital health statistics from governments around the world. And I only use government data and military data because it cannot be challenged. And lo and behold, I discovered diabetes was extremely rare globally before 1945, and almost all children who got it died by the time they were 7. So it wasn't genetically passed on by children who had it. And the increase in pancreatic cancer in Japanese males between 1945 and 1965 increased like 12-fold in 20 years. And so then I began looking for other studies, peer-reviewed scientific studies and government data, and I discovered that large increases in diabetes were reported in Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors of the bombings, in Chernobyl victims, in people who lived around nuclear power plants and were exposed to fresh fission products. And then I started hearing that our own soldiers returning from Iraq have not only Gulf War syndrome, but they have diabetes too. And these are 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds who never had diabetes in their families, and they're coming back with it, horrible cancers all over their bodies within 6 months or a year or 2 years. And I said, I went to see the Manhattan Project scientist that I work with. He worked at the nuclear weapons lab in Livermore for 20 years. And he probably knows more about microbiology now than he does about nuclear weapons. And so we sat down, and I showed him all the data and the rainfall map for Israel and the bar graph for the rainfall patterns. And in many studies in Finland, in the Marshall Islands, in Europe, in Sweden, in Israel, there was absolutely a direct correlation for new cases of diabetes reported during the highest period of rainfall. And so I've really absolutely confirmed it now with many, many sources and studies. And I went out to see Marion Folk in Livermore, the Manhattan Project scientist. We sat down. I said, here is all the data. And he listened for about 30 minutes, and then he said, Loren, the only reason they're getting it within 2 months of exposure, it's not the radiation effect, and it's not the chemical heavy metal effect. It's the tiny particle effect, the particulate effect of nanoparticles. And these are biologically the worst toxin known to man.
Okay, could you just repeat for us, kind of summarize for us the actual manifestation diseases that come from exposure? We have cancer, we have birth defects, we have diabetes. What else? Chronic fatigue syndrome you mentioned?
Yes, neuromuscular diseases. The soldiers exposed in the Middle East, some of them come back in adult diapers.
Is that like ALS?
They lose control of their body functions. They get grand mal seizures, and they have all kinds of brain problems. They can't remember anything. They're coming back, and the brain damage damages their impulse control mechanism, and they're murdering their wives. there were four soldiers who murdered their wives within 2 months of coming back from Afghanistan. Another soldier came back from Iraq, and right after Hurricane Katrina, he and his girlfriend were living in the French Quarter in New Orleans, and he killed her and cut her up and put her in cooking pots and cooked her on the stove.
Well, this is really depressing stuff.
And not only that, it's there are endocrine problems. There are digestive system problems. There's an epidemic of cancer, blood diseases, mental illness. It just trashes the whole body, not to mention the DNA damage in the sperm and the eggs. And they've even got it in their semen, and they internally contaminate their wives and partners, and they get sick. And the babies that are born, not just in the regions that are contaminated, but in the returning soldiers, they look just like Iraqi babies. And these poor soldiers and their wives can't get out of the military because they won't get medical care, and the whole family is sick and dying together. I want to tell you how serious it is. After World War II, we had a medical disability rate of 5% in our veterans. After Vietnam, because they used Agent Orange, it doubled to 10%. But since 1991, when these soldiers that are exposed to depleted uranium on the battlefield and off the battlefield, the medical disability rate is over 55% in our soldiers, and that doesn't even include or consider that they contaminate their families.
Yeah, the statistic I remember is that the coalition forces used 320 tons of DU in the 1991 Gulf War, and they used 10 times that many in the 2003 war in Iraq. Is that about
they,
right?
They from the data at Aldermaston that Dr. Chris Busby was able to get, they have continuously grid-bombed and carpet-bombed Iraq and other countries since 1991. They never stopped.
Mm.
And so they have used hundreds and thousands of times more depleted uranium than they've admitted to.
Mm.
Now, what they've admitted to using is the equivalent of 400,000 Nagasaki bombs. But what we know is that 800 tons of uranium, depleted uranium, is the equivalent to 83,000 Nagasaki bombs. And from World War II on, the main purpose and target of wars and weapons of war is its depopulation of the civilian population. And what they want to do is to depopulate the world by 2 to 4 billion, one-third to two-thirds of the world's population. And this is absolutely stated in National Security Council memos. Henry Kissinger said it himself in a National Security meeting in 1974. And when you look at the increases in death rates and the decreases in birth rates since 1991, they are carrying out depopulation with global pollution of depleted uranium in the atmosphere.
Well, with that note, I need to take a little break here, Lorraine. And this is
Katie. Oh, don't you like this happy news?
Oh, yeah. Well, it gives us
isn't
something
it good. Empowering?
Okay, this is member-supported KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And we accept all donations. And this is Truth Quest with Melody and co-host Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And our guest is Lorraine Murray. And as a disclaimer, the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. And I needed to do a couple of public service announcements here, too. And the Central Colorado Food Shed Alliance invites you to an evening of harvest celebration. The event is Saturday, October 6, 2007, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Senior Center in Salida, Colorado. Local producers and others who are really interested in local food will have booths to introduce you to their programs and products. Doug Wiley from the Larga Vista Ranch in Boone, Colorado will be the evening speaker on the issues of agriculture. There will be a light meal of bread and soup as well as tasting of local produce. Music will be provided. There is a small entrance fee. Come and enjoy the evening, your local producers, and find out what is happening in local food production. Call 539-8523 for more information. And the Chief County Democrats will meet Saturday, October 6, 2007, from 8:30 to 10 a.m. at Bongo Billy's Community Room, 300 West Sackett Avenue, Salida, for coffee and conversations. Topics of local and national interest are discussed in an informal setting. All community members are welcome. Again, this is Truth Quest. And Loren Murray, go ahead.
I think we're getting down to the nitty-gritty here, Loren, and it is very difficult stuff. You've answered the question, I think, why they're being used, which is an attempt at the depopulation of most of the world's human population. And this, of course, begs the question, what kind of monsters would contemplate, or let alone execute, such an activity? And do they think that they have some kind of antidote which will make them immune to the effects of this stuff?
Well, they don't really care, and also they're in denial. You know, George Herbert Walker Bush and Barbara Bush both had their thyroids removed because they had thyroid cancer from atmospheric testing fallout. And the mother's thyroid sends signals to her brain, and her brain controls the development of the brain of the fetus. And so damage to her thyroid does brain damage to the fetus. Now, every one of Barbara Bush's children, she has six children, suffered learning disabilities. And President Bush had a toddler sister named Robin who died of leukemia during atmospheric testing. George Bush and Barbara Bush took Robin to the big military hospital in Maryland, Walter Reed, and they didn't even tell the other children that she was sick or where they'd taken her. When she died in that room, they walked out the door and went off and played golf the rest of the day, and they never buried their daughter. It was the grandmother, Barbara Bush's mother, who buried Robin 2 years after she died. So that's a president who is a leader who really doesn't care even about his own children. President Kennedy was the opposite. Everyone knows that Jackie Kennedy had many pregnancy problems, and they had a little baby boy named Patrick who died right after he moved into the White House. And it was actually President Kennedy who heard about the link between atmospheric bomb testing fallout, the radiation, and leukemia in children. And he asked Dr. Ernest Sternglass, who I worked very closely with, to please testify in Congress, and Sternglass helped convince the Senate to sign the partial test ban treaty. So here are two presidents who have very different positions on the same issue.
And different personal life experiences that reflect that. In terms of the long-term effects, of course, of this kind of exposure, I guess we can expect that there will be some genetic mutations that will have an influence on evolution of many species. Would you say that?
Well, there's so much nuclear pollution now in the atmosphere that it's affecting all living things and the genome of the entire planet. They've altered the genome of the entire planet in less than 50 years, and it took 4.5 billion years for that very complex system to evolve in balance. And even Dr. Mueller, before 1920, he was a microbiologist who wanted to study evolution. He was a biologist, and he started exposing fruit flies to X-rays to study the genetic mutations expressed over the next 40,000 generations for just one male fruit fly. And the genetic damage was expressed over every one of those 40,000 generations. The damage is permanent. There's never repair of the DNA damage.
Going back to my question about antidotes, I've heard that iodine helps the thyroid survive exposure to radioactive materials or foods with iodine in it. Is that correct?
Yes, but radioactive iodine, which is what the iodine antidote is used for to protect the thyroid, that's only produced in nuclear bombs, in fission explosions or fission processes like nuclear power plants. There's no radioactive iodine produced from depleted uranium.
Oh.
There are many other decay products because uranium turns into polonium and radon and 25 other radioactive isotopes before it becomes lead and it becomes inert. So I call depleted uranium the Trojan horse of nuclear war because it's the weapon that keeps giving. It's the weapon that keeps killing. There's no way to turn it off, and there's no way to clean it up. And Eric, radiation respects no borders, no socioeconomic class, and no religion. And even Rehnquist, the head of the U.S. Supreme Court, who threw out or dismissed two major radiation lawsuits that had been won for radiation survivors and atomic veterans, he dismissed with one sentence both of those lawsuits. He just said the government has immunity. And guess what? He died of thyroid cancer.
Going back, I'm still puzzling to perhaps there's no simple answer to this. If there is no antidote and no borders or socioeconomic class or certain kinds of humans are necessarily immune from this, what is our ruling elite, the ones in the City of London and the Rothschilds and the whatever, the Bushes, What's their plan for survival? Are they going to get underground cities going, or do they have one?
Well, David Rockefeller doesn't have cancer yet, or maybe they cured it. But there is no antidote. There is no antidote. There's no way to treat 500,000 or more soldiers now who are sick in the United States. And basically, they go to these wars and they're exposed. They're not even wars. It's just insurgency. Or they're just acting as police forces, but they're inhaling the air, drinking the water, and eating the food that's contaminated. And they are exposed and they come back and there's just no way to treat them. You can't get it out of the body. You can't chelate it out of a person's body because it's insoluble. That when uranium oxides form at very high temperatures, and this is 5,000 degrees centigrade or higher, they're just basically insoluble. And these are the medical disabilities diagnosed by the VA in 631,174 veterans from the 2003 Iraq War. This is about 630,000 veterans. Okay, the top diagnosis was musculoskeletal problems, 87,590 soldiers. Mental, 73,154 soldiers. Ill-defined conditions, almost 68,000. Gastrointestinal, 63,000. Neural, and this is from DU plus the pesticides, 61,524. Endocrine, nutritional, metabolic, over 36,000. Respiratory, 36,000. Poisoning, 36,000. Circulatory, cardiovascular, over 29,000. Dermatitis, these are heavy metal allergies to depleted uranium, 29,000 cases. Kidney, urinary, almost 19,000. Benign neoplasms, this is cancer before it loses its growth control mechanism, almost 7,000. Malignant neoplasms, that is full-blown tumors, a little about 1,600, and blood disease is 3,591. So you can see cancer is almost the least common. It's at the bottom of the list. It's the tip of the iceberg.
Now, do vaccinations come into that a factor at all? Or?
Oh, it's cofactors and it's synergistic effects where they multiply the effects of each other. But this is primarily the effects of the nanoparticle effect from the depleted uranium combined with the radiation and it's primarily the particulate effect when they're getting sick so fast.
When you were, you did a program on Hawaiian bombing range over there. Would you like to get in that a little bit?
Sure. After I had worked with Major Doug Rockey, for a number of years, I met him in about 2002. I realized that it had been a total cover-up on depleted uranium at the federal level, in the Pentagon, in Congress, under three presidents. And I knew that there would be no way to break through at the federal level because they'd been so successful at hiding it. And, of course, they had a lot of practice, all during the nuclear weapons program and nuclear power program, so they know how to hide it. And I said, well, gee, maybe if I go to the state level, to the state legislatures, they would be more responsive. And so 2 years ago, I took a depleted uranium bill that could not pass in the Connecticut legislature, and I took it down to New Orleans and to an anti-war rally, and I gave it to a Vietnam veteran who asked me for it. You won't believe it, Melody. He had the governor signed it into law within 3 months, and the entire legislature voted for it unanimously, including a general on the Veterans Committee. So I went, wow, was that beginner's luck? And there are over 33 or 35 bills that have been introduced in state legislatures, and some states have passed the bill to test soldiers for depleted uranium. And I knew that Hawaii had a big military presence and community, and so I wanted to do it sort of symbolically in Hawaii. So I went to Hawaii last October, and I started talking about, I said, all your bombing and gunnery ranges in Hawaii are contaminated with depleted uranium because they practice dropping nuclear weapons with depleted uranium dummy bombs. They were shooting missiles all over the place over there, and the Davy Crockett, which was the smallest mini nuclear missile ever made, and the tail fins of those things were all over the bombing and gunnery ranges. So I knew Hawaii was very contaminated, plus riding the public bus every day to the Hawaiian legislature to testify. I had never seen such a sick society, so many illnesses in my life. And these are people who should have been very healthy out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, away from radiation and everything. Well, they weren't. The highest rainout in the world was in Hawaii from the bomb testing fallout. The highest plutonium levels were there. And then the depleted uranium was added to it. And the citizens said they didn't believe me in October. And when I left in November, I said, well, it's too late. I put a DU Velcro patch on your brain, and you're going to start having information stick there. And when I came back in January, this last January, they were furious at me. They said, we've been looking on the Internet, and everything you said is true, only it's worse than you told us. And they had three depleted uranium bills introduced in the legislature. Well, all of them failed. I spent 2 months in Hawaii testifying, and when the last one failed, I got on a plane and went to the Big Island of Hawaii because I knew they were shooting DU at Pohakaloa, which is an army training range between the two big volcanoes, Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa. and it's between Kona and Hilo. So I borrowed a Geiger counter, went up and did a survey of the whole island, and found depleted uranium, elevated radiation levels around the training range. And then I went to a friend's house 35 miles down the Kona coast, and I just have the Geiger counter and a movie camera with me. And the wind was blowing that afternoon really briskly from the Pohakaloa area. And I said, gee, I wonder if I'll get any radiation reading. And we've seen the live fire flags up, you know, on either side of the base. And so I flipped it on, and oh, my God, I panicked. It went up to 93 counts a minute almost immediately and stayed high for 2 hours. And I called Doug Rocky and I called Marion Falk, and they verified that I was doing it correctly and that this was carried in the wind. And that night the wind died down and the breeze was coming from the ocean, and it dropped down to 3 to 9 counts a minute. And, of course, we videotaped it, so I flew back to Honolulu on Oahu and called up Dick Allgaier at KITV, it's the ABC station in Hawaii. And I said, Dick, I've got a story for you. He said, did you videotape it? And I said, yeah. He said, I'll do the story. And that was the beginning of the biggest tsunami that's landed on the military in Hawaii ever, because that story went all over the world. It created an uproar all over Hawaii, and now other countries have asked me to help them. I got citizens in Hawaii to buy Geiger counters, plug them into their computers, and they're sitting around the bombing and gunnery ranges since May doing air monitoring, and they're taking a sample every minute. It's in a database. They can print it out, and this is horrible for the Army, because they are prohibited in their own regulations from using depleted uranium anywhere except on a live battlefield in another country. So this is very significant, and I know that your region in Colorado is contaminated with depleted uranium, and what they want to do now is expand the training areas. They want to take over a huge part of Colorado, almost a quarter of the state, and they'll just poison all the towns and the cattle and the pets. And
that would be the water, too?
The children and the water and the air. They're going to poison your whole area, and it's permanent.
Now, why would they want to do this, and how would they do it?
Well, they're using the depleted uranium to completely poison and contaminate regions where there are mineral sources, resources, oil that the United States wants to control. It's actually, the U.S. is actually a military proxy for Britain now. And so Britain is just using us to establish a military presence. We're the cop for Britain, for the London and Wall Street bankers. And they want to control all the energy resources and prevent Russia from being able to export their own vast oil and gas resources, and they want to contain China.
You mentioned something also when you were on Hawaii, that they were using some sort of on their test range about some sort of a mini-nuclear weapon.
That was the Davy Crockett.
And they're using that in the battlefield?
No, that was developed for the Korean War, and it was actually the very last atmospheric test done in 1963 at the Nevada test site. Bobby Kennedy observed it, and so they took them to Hawaii, and they must have used, I hope they used, depleted uranium warheads in them, but they did have depleted uranium spotting rounds, and so they would shoot the spotting round that would catch on fire, the uranium would burn, and they could see if the spotting round hit the target, and then they would shoot the missile at the target knowing that it was aimed correctly. Now, I hope they didn't have the nuclear warheads in those Davy Crockett's. I think they were using depleted uranium warheads, but we're not sure about that yet. And the tail fins from those spotting rounds are all over Schofield Barracks and all over Pohakaloa that we know of. We believe they were shot on other training ranges as well.
Are you suggesting that they would do the same thing here in Colorado?
Well, the Davy Crockett is no longer a viable weapon system. They don't use them. But they have definitely been practicing in Colorado, in your area, with depleted uranium, for instance, around Fort Collins and other gunnery ranges. Any bombing and gunnery ranges in the United States are potentially and most probably contaminated with depleted uranium because they practiced for Iraq, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia. They've been practicing for four decades since 1973, and we know that at least 37 states are contaminated with depleted uranium already from testing, manufacture, storage, and sale of depleted uranium munitions.
I'm starting to see the kind of a global picture here now. You're saying that they deliberately contaminate areas that are rich in mineral sources so
okay.
that it's easier to control those areas. Certainly this is what's happening to the Middle East now.
Yes,
you're suggesting that it's going to go here, too.
Yes, let me read. They don't. We're just all part of the national sacrifice zone. Let me read to you what Henry Kissinger said in a National Security Council meeting. This is from the National Security Memo 200, April 24, 1974. And the title of this memo is Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests. Quote, Dr. Henry Kissinger proposed in his memorandum to the National Security Council that this is quoting him, depopulation should be the highest priority of U.S. foreign policy towards the third world, unquote. He quoted reasons of national security and because the U.S. economy will require large and increasing amounts of minerals from abroad, especially from less developed countries. Wherever a lessening of population can increase the prospect for such stability, population policy becomes relevant to resources, supplies, and to the economic interests of the U.S. That's the end of the memo quote.
Do you think that has any tie-in with
According to an NSC spokesman at the time, the United States shared the view of former World Bank President Robert McNamara that the population crisis is a greater threat to U.S. national security interests than nuclear annihilation. In 1975, Henry Kissinger established a policy planning group in the U.S. State Department's Office of Population Affairs. Now, this is what they're carrying out now. Listen to this. By 1979, depopulation was the top priority of U.S. national security policy, as outlined in the national security paper, Global 2000, written by Rockefeller contractors Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, General Alexander Haig, and Ed Muskie for President Carter. And the Rockefellers brought the concept of depopulation or eugenics to the U.S. from England in 1920. And the Bush and Harriman families and the Rockefellers are the elite of the American eugenics movement. And that is what the Genome Project is for. It's to develop ethnic-specific bioweapons. And Johns Hopkins University and the University of California are the two death merchants for Skull and Bones, which is at Yale University, and that's where the sons of the Wall Street banking establishment go. And George Herbert Walker Bush and President Bush are both were both members of Skull and Bones, and so was Senator John Kerry.
Well, we certainly, you know, find a lot to agree with you on this. This is a lot of what you've said certainly has been researched and borne out. But going back to this Colorado depopulation scenario here, you were talking about a plan to militarize Colorado. You assume it has to do with the gas and the oil mineral resources here?
No, it's expanded military bases, and they need what's happened is the Navy announced during a command changeover, Pacific Command changeover in May, when I was in Honolulu, the Navy announced, in fact, it's the new Chief of Staff, Admiral Mullen, said, well, we're moving 75% of our personnel and ships to the Pacific region because the Atlantic is not of interest anymore. The commerce and so forth and so on is going to be happening in the future in the Pacific. And so they need to expand their military presence and to surround China and to contain Russia with its vast oil and gas deposits. And so they have to expand all their military bases and their gunnery ranges and artillery ranges. And what happened, I mean, the armies just kind of turned all their soldiers into uranium meat, and they're taking prisoners and kids out of juvenile hall and inner city gang members. They're sending them to Iraq now. But what is planned under the EU, and this is the Constitution that just failed. It was over 300 pages long. But it mandated that every country in the EU who signed the Constitution would maintain a military that would be turned over to NATO under U.S. Command. And so what they are going to do in the future is to get soldiers from other countries, force other countries, to turn their military over to the U.S. And they need these expanded bases in Korea, in Okinawa, in Hawaii, in Colorado, wherever they can put them to train the soldiers that they're going to use to contain China and Russia. And they need places for them to practice with depleted uranium. The Striker Battalion, they're looking for a place to permanently house the Strikers. The Strikers are light armored vehicles that are not suitable for insurgency or Iraq or places like that. They are actually for domestic inner city warfare. It's called, let's see what they call it. They call it, it's just insurgency in our own cities. And when people start realizing what they're doing to the U.S., there's going to be all hell is going to break out.
Are you tying this in with somewhat with the North American Union then?
Yes, yes. And these Strikers shoot depleted uranium bullets. These are not for foreign warfare. They can't sustain the damage caused by road bombs and stuff. And they wanted to put them in Hawaii. And then they set up the super ferry and told the citizens of Hawaii that the super ferry was to transport tourists and civilians in their cars between the islands. But because of the depleted uranium issue that I blew up, the Striker, the citizens realized the super ferry was really to transport the Strikers that were going to be contaminated with DU between the islands. And then the ferry company refused to do an environmental impact statement on the impact of the ferry on the environment. They travel 40 miles an hour, and they just shred whales and mammals and anything that's in the way. And Then lawsuits started getting filed against the super ferry, and then all the truth has been coming out in the court that the governor and the government of Hawaii exempted the super ferry from an EIS, and the judges said, well, that's illegal. They have to do one. And the ferry company said, we're leaving Hawaii. We refuse to do an EIS. And so now the next choice is Colorado. In other words, you guys are in the crosshairs. And the problem with the EIS that I saw, you can write to the Army and ask them to send you the EIS. They send it on a little DVD. It's about a foot thick if you want to read it on paper. And they scored Hawaii, Colorado, and Alaska on suitability on a different parameters, water supply and so forth. And Hawaii just did not do well at all. It has too many rare plants, and there's not enough water, and there are a lot of problems in Hawaii. I don't think the Strikers will be housed there, and the super ferry isn't even operating now because the citizens surrounded it on Kauai in the harbor and wouldn't let it land.
It looks like that goes against all the environmental sustainability things that they're really pushing in the state, right?
That's right. And actually, in the EIS report on Hawaii, it scored Colorado, too. And Colorado also has a water shortage, and there are also environmental problems in Colorado, although Colorado scored a little higher than Hawaii did. It's not quite as fragile an environment, but we sort of think it looks like the Strikers are going to end up in Alaska and probably the super ferry, too. But another thing that came out in court, this is very interesting, the ferry company actually spent a lot of extra money, and I think the ferry cost $40 million. They had to spend a lot of extra money to get the fuel tanks expanded on the ferries so that they could travel across the Pacific. So they are definitely not for inter-island tourism. They are for global militarism.
I have to ask you, what is a striker again?
Oh, a striker is it's a light armored vehicle which is on wheels. It's not on tracks like a tank or like an Abrams tank.
Okay.
And they don't have enough armor on them. They've been using them over in Iraq, and that's why. One of the reasons we have really high injury rates in these roadside bombings is because they just blow up the Strikers.
Okay. Loren, could we shift to 911? No, that's going to take a little bit of time.
Yes.
What have you just – you've done an awful lot of research, and I know you were at a conference recently on 911. Could you tell us what you've learned about the weapons that were used there?
Yes. I wasn't that interested in 911 when it happened, but on the day of 9/11, I did call up a radiation expert I work with, Dr. Jeanette Sherman, who lives in Alexandria, Virginia. She just lives 12 miles downwind from the Pentagon, and we just had been doing a radiation survey at the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard in San Francisco 3 days before. So I knew she had a Geiger counter in her purse, and I said, hey, Janet, get your Geiger counter out and start doing air monitoring. You're just downwind from the Pentagon. So she called me back a few hours later, and she said, oh, my God, the radiation levels are 8 to 10 times higher than normal. They're sort of swinging between 88 and 93 or 94 counts per minute. And normal backgrounds about 9 to 12 counts a minute. So I asked her to photograph it and document it. And I wanted to warn the emergency responders at the Pentagon to get into full highest level protective clothing and air tanks on their backs. So we contacted the EPA and HAZMAT and the FBI through an agency there. And 2 days later, The radiation expert for the ETA contacted back and confirmed that the crash site rubble at the Pentagon was radioactive and probably contaminated with depleted uranium. But he said, but we're only really worried about the lead that splattered around from the solder in the plane. It was just incredible that he said that. And then later on, Major Doug Rocky told me that a colonel in the Pentagon sent him an email 20 minutes later and said, oh, a cruise missile just hit the Pentagon. And, of course, cruise missiles have depleted uranium warheads in them. So now there's really very little doubt. There's been a lot of research done on the Pentagon, and we know a cruise missile hit the Pentagon. Now, in New York City, it's much more complex because the Pentagon is only one entity involved, which is the military. So whatever happens at the Pentagon, the military has to be involved. In New York City, you have property owners, the Port Authority, the EPA, all kinds of vested interests, Larry Silverstein, the landlords, and so forth and so on. And I began to look at the World Trade Center building, and I've been to conferences, and Judy Wood just gave her, and Morgan Reynolds just gave an excellent presentation at Jim Fetzer's Madison, Wisconsin. He did it with Kevin Barrett. They really did have a groundbreaking 9/11 conference, and the DVDs will be coming out any day, and you can get them from Jim Fetzer and Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And I recommend that people get them. Now, at the World Trade Center building, in the first place, when a controlled demolition is carried out, the rubble pile that is left after the building is collapsed is one-third the height of the building. So at the World Trade Center, those buildings were like 110 or 115 stories. So the rubble pile should have been 30 or 40 stories high. And when you look at the World Trade Center building footprints from aerial photos, there's nothing there. Those buildings vanished into thin air. There's no rubble pile. It's incredible. There are 26-foot diameter round holes that are in the footprint of the two World Trade Center buildings. And those have to be the signature of directed energy weapons. In other words, those buildings and all of the rubble was just simply turned into dust. And the only thing that can do that to that volume of building material, it's called molecular dissociation, is some kind of a beam, an energy beam weapon. They're called DEW, directed energy weapons. And a military plane was flying over those buildings the whole time it was happening. And I actually, in 1991, I went out in the middle of the night where I lived in Livermore, and I saw a demonstration of one of those directed energy weapons. And it was a beam, amber-colored beam, going straight up into the atmosphere. It was 20 feet in diameter. They had diverted air traffic for a five-mile radius around the city of Livermore. And I actually observed that. And I asked the graduate student who had taken me outside, he was renting a room for me that summer, what was that for? And he said, oh, they're making a star up there in the sky. And I said, yeah, but laser beams don't make stars. They take them apart. And he didn't say very much. But they're definitely signatures of directed energy weapons. And as a scientist and as an expert on particles, the smaller the particles are, the greater the amount of energy that's needed to break those molecules apart. And those buildings just vanished into thin air. It's impossible for that to happen. And an emeritus professor who's an international expert on air pollution, his name is Dr. Thomas Cahill. He's an emeritus professor at UC Davis in California. And he was asked by a member of the Department of Energy to do air monitoring after October 5th. And he did air monitoring a mile downwind from the World Trade Center for 5 months, and he reported the largest bulk mass of nanoparticles ever measured in air samples in the United States. So there were definitely very, very, very small particles produced in a very large volume.
And you think when you think that plane would have had the ability to carry
a laser weapon. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are now land and air-based and sea-based, and they can also use HARP. They're also space-based now. So they definitely used directed energy weapons to powder the buildings. Now, they needed also to use energetic devices, explosives, to break down the structure of the World Trade Center buildings. And the architect, who was Japanese, designed both of those buildings to basically be like a pipe. They were very, very well fortified, and he also designed them to withstand planes flying into them. And that was pretty wise because they were the tallest buildings in the world. And they had to use explosives. I was a speaker at the first international 9/11 conference in Tokyo last October, and William Rodriguez is a very good friend of mine, and he absolutely told us that horrible explosives went off in the basement in the elevator before the first plane hit the building. Now, Ace Baker, who was another speaker at Jim Fetzer's conference in Madison a month ago, did a very, very convincing presentation, and this will be on the DVDs too. He demonstrated how the media footage of the planes flying into the World Trade Center buildings had been sort of created with something like Photoshop. No planes hit those buildings. They were rockets. And there were also, there's footage showing the laser target being painted on the buildings for some kind of a kinetic energy penetrator to hit the buildings. There's just more and more evidence and more whistleblowers emerging now. But very simply, you have to start with the energy budget required to produce that huge volume of dust, and it cannot be done with conventional explosives. Chemical explosives do not release enough energy to do that. And so there was thermite used, and that was probably used to cut the steel beams. They cut railroad tracks with thermite, so it's not unseemly that they would have cut the steel beams with thermite. But that they used more than that, and Major Doug Rocky was sitting right in front of me during Dr. Judy Wood's presentation, and Doug just swirled around and said, "Lorraine, they had to use mini nukes on the World Trade Center." He said the evidence is right there. I have never seen these photos or this evidence before. And Doug Rocky is very familiar with nuclear weapons and explosives. And he also trained all the firefighters and the policemen in New York City in terrorism. And he was completely convinced by her presentation that directed energy weapons and some kind of nuclear devices. Many nukes were used to take those World Trade Center buildings down.
What about Building 7?
Well, that was done with conventional explosives, and that's not too hard to explain. But they were in place sometime before 9/11. And then, of course, FEMA and other agencies were doing exercises, and it's really funny because every time they start doing those exercises, and the military was doing exercises in Kuwait, and they suddenly went live when Gulf War I started. So anytime these agencies or the military are doing exercises, we better watch what they're doing, because those are very likely to go live.
Loren, we had Jim Fetzer on our program about a month and a half ago, and we heard some of these ideas, discussed them, and he mentioned kind of a brief history of the Scholars for 911 Truth and the fact that there was a schism between he and Steve Jones, and that Steve Jones broke off and started a new organization. Could you give us your impression about Dr. Steve Jones's research? He's the guy that's insisting that it was just thermite.
Yeah.
Thermite.
No. Steve Jones is definitely part of the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, and the whole 9/11 movement is a big counterintelligence program. Just like the John F. Kennedy assassination investigation, this is how they cover all of this up, and they did it on the Robert Kennedy assassination as well. And I've been to the 9/11 conferences. I've been invited as a speaker. I know the people and the players very well, and it's just a counterintelligence program. Now, I was very interested in Stephen Jones, and I began investigating him, and you better watch out when I put my laser beam on you and start hitting a target on you, because I find out everything. And what I discovered is that in the mid-1980s, when two scientists named Pons and Fleischmann discovered cold fusion, and they actually got the Nobel Prize for it, Stephen Jones did some cockamamie report which destroyed their ability to patent their discovery. And I discovered that, what that did was that allowed the nuclear weapons labs to get cold fusion for free. And
meanwhile, these two professors were hounded out of the university and had to leave in shame with their tail between their legs. Isn't that
correct? Right. And so that's just what the nuclear weapons labs do to people. They steal their intellectual material.
Uh-huh.
And Steve Jones was a major player in facilitating that the horrible things that happened to them. And so Stephen Jones was pushing this thermite theory, and he and I had a number of conversations, and I said, really, the Achilles heel of 9/11 is the Pentagon, and we should be investigating them first, because the only entity there was the military. And it's also probably the most protected building in the United States. So he didn't want to talk about that anymore, so I went to some of his talks, and you know, he's kind of mousy, and he's kind of a passive aggressive, and he reminds me of David Ray Griffin. And so I really started digging into Stephen Jones. And he cornered me at the Vancouver 9/11 conference, which was at the end of June. And we started talking about the dust, and he said, oh, I got lots of samples. And I said, well, how far were you from the World Trade Center building? And he said, oh, 25 or 50 feet. And I know what I'm talking about, and I'll analyze any of your samples anytime you want me to. And I said, well, let's start talking about the particles and the particle size. And he said, well, you weren't there, and you don't have any samples to talk about. I said, I don't need them. I want to talk about the energy budget and the nanoparticles that were produced. And he didn't even know what I was talking about. And I said, the particles that you collected 25 or 50 feet or yards from the World Trade Center buildings were the biggest particle sizes that settle out from gravity. But there were huge amounts of nanoparticles produced, which are invisible in air, and they float away right away. So I said, you may think you have an air sample or a particle sample, but you missed that whole fraction of the particulates. And Dr. Cahill reported that nanoparticles were a very high percentage in his samples, and that was months after 9/11. So then I started investigating Stephen Jones' ties to the nuclear weapons labs and to DOE, and he's very, very tied and very involved with them. So he's just a contractor for the nuclear weapons labs, and I am now convinced that Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab was involved in the explosive devices, the nuclear devices, whatever they were, that were used on the World Trade Center building. Now, something very interesting happened. We got bomb crater samples from Lebanon after the Israeli attack in July of 2006, last summer, and Dr. Chris Busby analyzed the samples at the Harwell, the radiation laboratory in England, and this is the official government radiation laboratory, so they're not making mistakes. And he said, Loren, they discovered the samples had deuterium in them. And I said, deuterium is used in fourth generation and other nuclear weapons. It's not used in depleted uranium bunker busters. So what was it doing in these bunker busters? He said there were very high levels of uranium-235. That's too high for depleted uranium bombs. And I said, well, that's another anomalous irregularity. And he said also in the bomb craters, the Lebanese scientists measured and monitored the radiation from the day the bombs were dropped. And the radiation dropped off very, very quickly within 3 weeks, almost to nothing. And I said, well, that's neutron activation from the fast neutrons created in a nuclear explosion. And that is not from the depleted uranium bunker buster bomb. And he said, you know, they can make cold fusion devices the size of matchboxes now.
Boy, isn't he just a wealth of information here?
This is true. I don't think we're going to let you stop here,
Brett.
We both have more questions.
Well,
I would like to ask real quick here before Melody gets a chance to wind us up. You said a fascinating thing that the whole 911 movement is a COINTELPRO or counterintelligence program such as the FBI carried out back in the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Could you elaborate and tell me, because I've watched this thing carefully. You imply that David Ray Griffin might be one of them, and who else?
Oh, David Ray Griffin is affiliated with the Club of Rome. That was started by the CIA. He also made the mistake of asking me to write a chapter for his last book.
Uh-huh.
And I asked for a list of the contributors, who else would be in the book. And I discovered that Richard Falk, a Princeton professor, he's an international expert on genocide. I absolutely hate him. I detest him. And I discovered that he was the co-editor and was contributing a chapter. And he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And David Ray Griffin made the mistake of telling me that Richard Falk helped him write the new Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
So who can we trust in the 911 movement? I suppose Fetzer, Judy Wood, who?
Well, I think Judy Wood has done very excellent work, and she's done a very credible scientific presentation. I think Jim Fesser and Kevin Barrett are very sincere. They were quite honest with me, and quite frankly, you could tell who's honest by a number of attacks they're subjected to.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are other very good presenters. Ace Baker did an excellent job on the deconstructing the news videos of the planes hitting the building. Doug Rocky has done excellent work, Major Doug Rocky, and there are others who maybe aren't as famous as Webster Tarpley or David Ray Griffin or Stephen Jones. They're known as the three popes of 9/11. But, you know, when I went to the 9/11 Truth Conference, which was in Washington, D.C. in July of 2005, it was at the American University campus. The organizers, and this is David Kubiak and Janice Matthews, and also Gabriel Day, they completely and totally screwed up and sabotaged the conference. There were talks in buildings all over that conference. There was no agenda. There was no program. There was something scribbled on a piece of paper the night before and stuck on one door. And they had completely taken my name off of my workshop and put two other people on. They'd invited me to Washington and paid my way and then took me out of my own workshop. And this was so obvious. The day of the conference, they went around and took all the signs off of the doors and switched all of the talks around to different rooms. And there was no agenda. There was no way to know where to go to listen to the talk you wanted to hear. And I took the film Beyond Treason to show it for the first time on the East Coast. I had a special room to show it in. Two people came, and it wouldn't play after 5 minutes.
Now, I have to ask you, is Webster Tarpley one of the, I feel like a gossip here, is Webster Tarpley one of the people that you would say you can trust or not?
Well, I think Webster Tarpley is a very sharp guy, and he's very, very interesting, but he's something of a fear-monger or an alarmist.
Yes.
And so I don't want to be emotionally manipulated. I want to be intellectually educated.
Yes.
And so when people start creating a lot of hype and scaring people and sending alarmist information out, I don't think that really helps with educating people about the issue.
Lorraine, I'm going to have to
I'd
love to have you back again so we can kind of follow up.
I think we both would.
And particularly the War Crimes Conference, and there's a whole lot more I'm sure that you haven't touched upon.
Sure.
And I sure really appreciate you coming on tonight.
Yeah,
thank you. And you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you my PowerPoint presentation, which I took all over Southeast Asia on radiation, and I want you to have that information and think about it, and you can post it anywhere. You can call me and ask me about it, and we can continue discussing this in order to educate your audience. And it's so nice to be on your program tonight.
Thank you for all the information. And I, for one, think you've done an incredible job, and I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Yes,
I just have incredible curiosity.
Yes, you do.
Okay, well, next program coming up is Joe Frank, and this is KATN.
Thank you very much, Lorraine.
106.9 Slide, and again, thanks, Lorraine.
Thank you, Melody and Eric. Thanks so much. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.